Today is March 6th. It's Tuesday morning at the Kiva Academy. We're learning Parshat Teshuva. This week's Parsha is Parshat Ki Tisa. Parshat Ki Tisa. We're beginning the last third of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. There's so much we could have done in this week's Parsha. So many interesting things. I chose something that's very, very minor. It's only one verse in the Parsha. But the reason I chose it, because it turns out to be a major elephant of Jewish life for the past 1,000 years. And that is the verse that says, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. This verse appears 3 times in the Torah, once in our Parsha of this week. So the first place is in Parsha Ki Tisa, chapter 34. This is the second time of the 3 times in the Torah. And we're going to read the larger context, although it might or might not have anything to do with the verse. The larger context is from verse 34, chapter 34, verse 17. You shall not make molten gods for yourselves. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then it goes on to give us the 3 pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. In the interim between the first of the pilgrimage festivals and the second and the third, it discusses the mitzvah of bringing the firstborn to God. That's in verse 19 and 20. And then verse 21 is about Shabbat. And verse 22 and 23 go back to the pilgrimage festivals. Verse 25 is still about Pesach. Verse 26, the choice first fruits of your soil you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. So the context is about idolatry, the prohibition against idolatry. It's about the 3 pilgrimage festivals. It's about Shabbat. It's about the temple. And then you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And we wonder if there's any connection between the context of the pilgrimage festivals and the temple and the prohibition against idolatry, any connection between that and you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk.
The other two times is the same context?
Very good question. Let's do that right now, but first Adam?
I was going to say, is it because they're holy? The Shabbat separated from the week, the holidays separated from the rest of the year, and then the distinction of Hashem with...
I'm not sure what you're asking.
I was just trying to answer you. Is it because that these are all holy things, things that are separate from other things?
Oh, I see. I don't know. I'm going to come back in another half an hour. But the truth is, there's not a very good and satisfying answer in the end. Ilana asked, is the context the same in the other 3 places which this appears in the Torah? The answer is yes and no. It's the same context in the other place in Exodus in which it appears you shall not seat a kid in its mother's milk. In Deuteronomy, it's a different context. So as far as Exodus goes, we're going back to Exodus 23. It's on the sheet in B1 if you're interested in seeing where it is. 23:19 in the book of Shemot. 23:19, this is Parshat Truma, which we read only 2 weeks ago. And there, it's the exact same context. It's actually the exact same mitzvot of Shabbat, of the 3 pilgrimage festivals, of don't commit idolatry, of bring the firstborn to the temple. And then in verse 19, the choice first fruits of your soil you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. I didn't read verses 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. They're the same context as we had in this week's Parsha. This unit of these 9 or 10 verses is almost word for word in these 2 Parshiot. It's a question, why does the same thing appear twice? In the book of Deuteronomy, the context is different. We don't even have to look there. There, all the different laws of kashrut are collected together. Of the animals you can eat, the animals that you can't eat, the creepy crawlers that are forbidden, the meat that's forbidden. And at the end of that unit of kashrut, it brings, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. 3 times the exact same words. So now, what do we do about this? How do we understand it? What's going on? The question of meaning, of reason, I'm going to leave for the end. Now let's just talk a little bit about the way the rabbis have understood this throughout the generations. I put on the sheet that I prepared at the beginning, in A list of all the different expansions and extensions, widening of this law that Jewish tradition has accepted as a given. If you read the verse, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk, you could think that it's only its own mother's milk, not the milk of another animal. It's only boiling. It's only a kid, which means only a goat and only under a certain age. But all of those things you could have thought are not true. Not true in the sense of the tradition from time immemorial. Before the oral Torah became written, there was an old tradition apparently going back a long, long time that it's beyond all the contractions that I just mentioned. And I listed them on the sheet. If you look in A2A, not just a kid in its own mother's milk, but in any milk. That's been assumed from time immemorial. Not just a kid, but even a grown animal. That's been assumed from time immemorial. Not just a goat or a lamb, but any animal that has milk.
And chicken.
Excluding chicken and fish, because they don't have milk. Right? Any animal that has milk, which means not just a goat, but also sheep and also cows. I guess it includes also kangaroos, I guess, right? I'm not really sure about that.
Except they're not kosher.
Right, that's the problem. It wouldn't apply to kangaroos, so really we don't have that much of an extension here.
It would apply to giraffes, though.
Llamas. Do giraffes have milk?
I don't know. I would guess.
Llamas.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we do have some extensions. Not kangaroos, but someplace else. I don't... Right, giraffe is kosher. The meat is kosher.
Right.
Really? Giraffe has...
They used to bring it to the temple.
Yes, that I don't know about.
No, they used to bring it to Solomon's temple, but they forgot how to shekht it.
Giraffe is kosher?
Actually, there was... there's a famous friend of mine who lives in Efrat in Israel. He's a dentist, but is involved in so many esoteric things in the Jewish world. Greenspan, his name is, Ari Greenspan. He is one of the persons involved in the reintroduction of Tehillit, the blue dye, to the Jewish world for the past 25 years. He also has a matzah baking factory in his basement. He also does stained glass windows, and he's also been involved in introducing giraffe meat back into the Jewish world. A few years ago, he arranged a banquet in which he collected traditions from all over the Jewish world of things that we eat, but we don't eat. In other words, things that are kosher, but that tradition has lost the methodology and the acceptance of doing it. He collected Yemenite Jews and Jews from this or that place, and he had a festival of chocolate-covered grasshoppers, and which are kosher, and of giraffe meat, and all other crazy things that you've never heard of. And he wanted to keep the tradition alive so we don't lose the way of eating it, not lose the acceptance of eating these things.
But
so,
from my point of view, the less we eat of all these lovely animals, the nicer it is. So slowly we're becoming better.
Even grasshoppers. Even grasshoppers.
They have a right to live.
Okay. I hear. So anyway, I brought here on the sheet Rashi's commentary on Shmot 23:19, who says as follows. A calf and a sheep are also implied in the word gedi. The word gedi is the one that is translated as kid, because gedi represents any tender newborn animal, as can be inferred from the fact that you find the number placed in the Torah that gedi is written. It is necessary to explain afterward gedi izim.
Right.
For example, we could look at what I brought here. Bereishit 38:17. Let's hold the place where we are now and go back to Genesis 38:17. You got it. 38:17. The translation here is going to kind of put a stumbling block in front of us, but we'll get over that by looking at the Hebrew. 38:17, as Ilana just said, is the famous story of Well, not Amnon, but Tamar.
No, right? Sorry, Yehuda, Tamar and Yehuda.
Right, in which Yehuda used the services of what he thought to be a prostitute. It turns out to be his daughter-in-law, who had disguised herself as a prostitute, and she demands payment, of course. And what he says to her in verse 17 is, 38:17, he replied, "I will send Gedi Izim." Did I have the Hebrew right?
Min Hatzon.
Right? It says Gedi Izim Min Hatzon?
Yes.
Ah, right. So it says in the Hebrew, Gedi Izim Min Hatzon, which literally means a kid of the goats from the flock. Do we have, I don't have any more. Yes, I do. Actually, I do have one more. Look at that. Gedi Izim Min Hatzon, three different words. A kid of the goats from the flock. So Rashi says as follows. What does the word Gedi mean? If it were to mean a young one of the goats, there would not be a need to say Gedi Izim, a Gedi of the goats. Just say Gedi, and you know that it's of the goats. So if there's a modifier that says of the goats, that must mean that the word Gedi does not necessarily apply of the goats, but it could be a young one of any other animal. And you have to modify it and say of the goats. That's Rashi's proof that the word Gedi does not necessarily mean it's not necessarily limited to that type of animal, which would mean, transferring this to our verse, when it says, do not boil a Gedi in its mother's milk, we refer not just to a kid of the goats, but also to a kid of the lamb, and also to a kid of the herd. That's Rashi's opinion. So as Rashi is saying, it doesn't require any rabbinic extension or any expanded understanding to interpret our verse as referring to all types of mammals. But on the other hand, the Ibn Ezra, in his commentary on our verses in Genesis, tries to prove that Rashi is wrong. And really the word Gedi does mean only of the goats. And if the halakha is, as it is, that the prohibition applies not just to goats, but also lamb and herd, well, that must be an extension. It's not explicit in the verses. By the way, if I mention Rashi and Ibn Ezra, I'll mention something I think I said in the past, which is this volume, right? This is the Mikrot Gedolot. I did mention this, right? The Mikrot Gedolot literally means the reader, the big reader, Mikra'a, from Kuf Resh Aleph, Kara, to read. Mikra means the written part of the Jewish tradition, the Tanakh. Mikrot Gedolot, the big reader, has been a traditional book for many hundreds of years in which the verses from the Torah are quoted in order, from the beginning of the Torah to the end of the Tanakh, and around them on the page are all the traditional commentators from the Middle Ages. And this now has been translated into English by the Jewish Publication Society. So you have here the Hebrew text and the Hebrew text and the English text, and Rashi and Ibn Ezra and Ramban, all the different commentaries from the Middle Ages around the margins. They're now doing Leviticus and then other books of the Torah, I think.
So far, I've been able to find three volumes. Not Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers.
So even Numbers?
I think so.
Ah, so they're going pretty quickly. When I said all the commentators, I should not have said all the commentators. I mean, first of all, it's only commentators from the Middle Ages that are in the Mikrot Gedolot, and not from before that, not from after that. And this volume doesn't bring all the commentators in the Middle Ages, it brings the major ones. Yeah. Right? You have Rashbam, the grandson of Rashi, you have the Ibn Ezra, you have the Ramban.
I have the two Targumim.
You have two translations into English. But traditionally, you have the Hebrew and the Aramaic translation. So this one has the Hebrew and two different English translations, so you can compare them. The old JPS and the new JPS. And that's also interesting. That's also interesting. I'm going to put that aside. Okay. Thank you. Going back to my list of expansions of this prohibition, in D, I wrote, this is A2D, not just boiling, but any type of cooking together. It's been assumed by the tradition that even if you broil or bake, but not just boil, the meat and the milk, then you are violating this prohibition.
That would cover cheeseburgers.
That would cover cheeseburgers, except for the fact that technically, listen to this, technically, according to the halakha, there's a prohibition against mixing meat and milk only if the meat is kosher meat.
Huh.
So if you have a cheeseburger at my house, then you'd be violating two prohibitions. One of, I'm sorry, just one prohibition of mixing meat and milk. But if you go and have your cheeseburger at McDonald's, you're technically not violating the prohibition of meat and milk. You're just violating the prohibition of unkosher meat.
Interesting. I'm a wannabe vegetarian, which means that on most given days of the week, I'm a vegetarian.
Your cheeseburger is soy. Yes.
Whenever the rabbis talk about, they make these kinds of connections like boiling and cooking. When we talk about the forbidden types of work, there's a forbidden statute on cooking, but you also have, there are a lot of different things that qualify as cooking. Is this determination for kashrut connected to that, or are they independent of each other?
Very interesting. The word that's used in the Torah, do not boil a kid in its mother's milk, is bishul, not levashel, a kid in its mother's milk. Now, what does that word bishul mean? Is it limited to boiling, or does it also include other types of cooking? For example, the laws of kashrut, I take it back, the laws of Shabbat. When bishul is one of the 39 forbidden labors on Shabbat, there bishul does not merely mean boiling, it means other types of cooking. So Adam says in this verse also, perhaps the word bishul, it's not that the rabbis expanded it to mean other types of cooking, rather, that's what the word means. However, in this case, what does the verse say? It says, do not levashel a kid in its mother's milk. In. When you talk about cooking in milk, clearly it's about boiling. Right? To cook meat in milk would be that the milk is being boiled. There's no other way to cook it in. But you could cook it beside, cook it with, cook it on top of, but if it says in, which is what it says, clearly the pshat therefore is that it's boiling. And you have to say that if the halakha goes beyond boiling, it's some type of expansion. Now, technically speaking, it might not be a rabbinic expansion. It might be a rabbinic expansion. What do I mean by that? I meant the following. That when the rabbis point out that a certain verse means something beyond what it seems to mean, they could be classifying what they're doing as a rabbinic expansion. That the rabbis are adding a fence around the Torah. Don't just boil it, for example, but also you're forbidden to broil it. That could be a rabbinic expansion. Or it could be not a rabbinic expansion. It could be rabbinic exegesis that tries to prove that that added meaning is already part and parcel of the Torah's intention. And the truth is, in all these different expansions that I wrote here, from A to G, they're all considered to be Doraita. They're all considered to be of Torah status, of Torah authority. The rabbis found them in the verse, as it were, not added them to the verse. At least technically, that's the way we classify it. Now, in most of these cases, we don't even know the rabbinic exegesis that allowed the rabbis to find these extensions in the Torah. We don't have any of that. We don't have the tradition. All we have is the Talmud assuming, not proving, not showing, not illustrating, but assuming that all of these extensions are part of the basic, original Torah meaning of the verse. Perhaps I'll take 5 minutes to explain how it could be that the Talmud doesn't prove and doesn't illustrate and doesn't derive these things, but just assumes them. It has to do with the very process of the development of Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. The oral law is called the oral law because
it was oral.
It was oral. Right, for many, many, many years, the oral law was oral. The law was 99% oral still in the year 70 of the common denominator of the
common era.
When the temple was destroyed, the second temple was still 99% oral. But with the destruction of the temple, and therefore the destruction of the centers of Jewish learning, with the dispersion of the sages and the Jewish people, with the economic, political, and religious persecutions that began decades later with the Hadrianic persecutions and the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Jewish people began to feel that the oral tradition might be lost. So it was written down. It was written down in the year 200 of the Common Era, approximately, with the editing of the Mishnah. And the idea was, the purpose was, to prevent the dissipation, the loss of the oral law. Rabbis were being killed by the Romans, Rabbi Akiva and his whole generation, the Hadrianic persecutions, and later with all the economic difficulties living in the land of Israel, the Jews are dispersing, there's less and less study, and there's a fear everything's going to be lost, so it's written down. But what is written down? Only the very, very basic reminders, an apodictic, what's called apodictic fashion, which means telegraphic fashion. Not the reasons and not the foundation, but just what the law is.
That's why it's so short.
That's the Mishnah, that it's so short. And the idea was it would be a reminder so that you can conjure up the rest of the tradition through these, what's called Rashi Prakim, just these title headings, these chapter headings. But to a large degree, the tradition that the Mishnah comes to remind you of was lost. The Mishnah says, we do this, we don't do that, we do this, we don't do that. But the why and the wherefore, the connection between the written Torah and the law, that is to say, the derivation and the source of all these laws, was lost. To a large degree lost. When you come after the year 200 and encounter the commentary on the Mishnah, which is the Babylonian and Israeli Talmud, what's called the Talmud of the Land of Israel, or the Palestinian Talmud, the Yerushalmi, and the Babylonian Talmud, you have to understand that these Talmudim are reconstructions. They're efforts to figure out what the Mishnah means, what its source was, how it was derived, where does tradition come from, but they are based to a large degree on Sfara, on use of the mind, and not based on tradition. The tradition was broken. So all of these many laws that we are learning today, the Mishnah knows that they're true. But why are they true? Where do they come from? What's their basis? When were they figured out? Don't know.
Now, the Braita was written or was kept orally?
Well, I'm kind of fudging that whole question here. The truth is that even the Mishnah in the year 200, when it was edited, some say it wasn't written. But I'm fudging that part of it. It's not clear. So let's go back to the list. We said in D, not just boiling, but any type of cooking together. E, not just cooking together, but also eating that which has been cooked together. What am I doing in E? I'm saying, wait a second. The verse says, "Do not cook." You might have thought that you're allowed to eat, just you can't cook it, but you can eat it, right? The verse only says do not cook it, but the rabbis assumed that eating it is also forbidden.
Somebody else could have cooked it.
Whether you cooked it or someone else cooked it.
Right.
Well, what if you didn't cook it? You have a ham and turkey and cheese, or
that's the next one, right? That's F. Thank you. Not just eating that which has been cooked together, but also eating together the two, even if not cooked together. The rabbis assumed that was also forbidden, but the verse certainly doesn't say it explicitly. And G, not just eating together, but even getting any benefit from such mixtures that are cooked together. Let's say, you hear what Tony just said, can't sell it. In other words, I didn't cook it, and I'm not going to eat it, but someone gave it to me, can I sell it? No. They're obviously can't sell it. And by the way, I had a question that was asked of me a few years ago by one of my students here in Dallas who's going to university and needed extra money for a job. Can he be a waiter in a non-kosher restaurant? So if it's a restaurant that only serves meat and vegetables, or just vegetables, well, sorry, that wouldn't be not kosher, just serves meat, well, yeah, you could. Because there's a prohibition against eating non-kosher meat, but there's no prohibition against getting benefit from it. So he could get his salary and tips from non-kosher meat, and that's fine. As long as he makes sure not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind. In other words, as long as he doesn't purposely serve it to someone Jewish who comes in. But as long as he doesn't know,
okay,
that's fine. But if the restaurant serves meat and milk, then there's a good reason not to be a waiter there. Because as far as meat and milk, it's not just that you're not allowed to eat it, you're also not allowed to benefit from it.
Kosher meat, though.
Right, I was waiting for someone to say that. But the truth is, the halakha does allow you to be a waiter there as long as you make sure the meat is not kosher.
Uh-huh. And you can have stuff.
Okay. Well, the meat is not kosher.
As long as the meat is not kosher. Because, as I said earlier, you're only forbidden in this whole prohibition of meat and milk if the meat is kosher. If the meat isn't kosher, then there's no problem of mixing meat and milk, and therefore there's only a isur, prohibition of eating it, but not of getting benefit from it.
So is there a value placed on whether there's two prohibitions or one?
Well, there are different types of prohibition, because the prohibition of meat and milk is more serious because it includes not just eating, but also benefit.
Okay.
So if you found a restaurant that served kosher meat with meat, milk, then there would be a direct prohibition of being a waiter there, getting a benefit from it.
Where's the source of that it's only limited to the kosher meat? Or is that just understood?
It's not here.
So it's all man-made, man interpretation. It's not come from God.
Well, that's what you say. Whereas I don't say anything. I just point out that all of these matters from A to G are assumed in the Talmud to be prohibited by the Torah, not telling us what the source is, where it came from, the Talmud doesn't know. We're about to see in a minute, or two or three, that one of these matters we mentioned, the Talmud does experiment and try to find the source for it. But since the Talmud brings three different possibilities of where the source comes from, you could know that it's trying on the basis of spara, logic, to find the basis, but we don't have a living, organic, continuous tradition.
With these laws, is it possible that they were, these expansions, or whatever you want to call them, they were given at Mount Sinai as part of the oral tradition?
Everything is possible.
I'm just trying to figure out, because the Gemara goes in and tries to do exegesis on the text, but maybe that's not correct if this was actually originally oral tradition.
Everything is possible, mm-hmm, because the Rama, for example, points out that the fact that the Talmud sometimes tries to find a logical source for any given law that doesn't seem to be written in Torah doesn't mean that what they find or what they mean to find is the source. It might just be a mnemonic, mm-hmm, to remember and to pin down the law, whereas the law might have an independent source.
That's the Rambam?
The Rambam says that. Not particularly in our case.
Yeah.
Just an example of the way Tosha Ba'peh might work.
Does the prohibition apply even to artificial milks? Soy milk, soy cheese?
It doesn't. It only applies to milk.
Only to animal milk.
The word assumes, the word assumes, the Talmud assumes. That bothers me.
Well, then let me explain a little bit further what I mean by assume.
Is it only kosher animal milk?
What if the milk is not kosher?
Wait a second. When I say the Talmud assumes, what I mean is that there's a living tradition of this is what we do, this is what we don't do, but we've lost the reason for it. In other words, the Talmud, the rabbis of the Talmud, they knew from their father, who knew from their mother, who knew from their mother, who knew from their father, that you don't have meat and milk together in the same mouthful, even if they're not cooked together. But where does it come from? How do we know that that's what's prohibited? That tradition is lost. Not that they make up an assumption, but they have a living tradition of this is the way we do things, this way we don't do things. But we don't know, in many cases, and not just in Kashrut, but in many, many laws, we don't know where it comes from. The Mishnah and, again, the oral living tradition tell us what we do and what we don't, but the why and the wherefore are very often not known to us. As you were saying?
Kosher milk. What if the milk is not kosher and the meat is not kosher? Well, the milk is kosher, but the meat is not.
So we already said, if the meat is not kosher, there's no prohibition.
But the milk is.
And the opposite is also true. If you, is there, does, do pigs make milk?
Yes.
Okay, so pig milk.
They're mammals.
Camels make milk as well.
And if you had camel or pig milk together with kosher meat, you would not be violating the prohibition of meat and milk, but you would be violating the prohibition of drinking milk from an unkosher animal. Right? It's forbidden, however you cut it, but it's of a different source. But of course, that would mean that you are allowed to benefit from a mixture of pig milk and kosher giraffe meat. You can benefit.
This is so common. It's available in every supermarket in America. Pig's milk.
So as long as it's not kosher, I can own a McDonald's franchise.
You can, you said.
I'm asking.
From this point of view, from this particular point of view.
As long as I don't serve kosher meat.
That's what it looks like.
Okay. And as long as you don't eat lunch there.
Right.
but you know what? Yeah. It's not so simple because there's a percentage of non-kosher meat on the market that's really kosher. Because in kosher slaughterhouses, they sell 30% of the meat to non-kosher establishments because they don't want to take the effort of taking the sciatica nerve out of it.
The what?
The Gita Moshe. It's a whole other story. Let me just mention one more thing before I go on.
So it is chashat kashrut.
One more thing is that this matter of benefit, it especially comes up in pet food. Yeah. Right? Really, you don't have to feed your animals kosher food. It could be non-kosher meat. But you can't feed them kosher meat together with milk. Because you're benefiting, you're getting a benefit from meat and milk mixtures.
I have to just tell this. When my son, who is now very super religious, when he was a kid, my friend and I were thinking of going into the Easter egg basket business. It was very new. And he had a fit. How can you go into a business where you're selling baskets of food to celebrate Easter?
Okay. It's definitely related.
There is a moral issue about it. Whether legally it's allowed or not, there's a moral dilemma about it. It's like selling
process. But is it legally allowed?
It depends on the question if Easter eggs are considered to be an accoutrement of idolatry, which actually is a halachic question. But if you were to say that there's some type of accessory to idolatry, and there are such opinions, then you wouldn't be allowed to get any benefit from Easter eggs. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's
okay. So now, going on in the sheet to A3, I listed three expansions of this law of meat and milk, A3 on the sheet, that are designated in our tradition specifically as rabbinic. They're not rabbinic exegesis that means to tell you that the Torah law is expanded, but they're specifically designated as rabbinic additions.
So one that's offense?
Offense, right. One is not just meat, but also fowl. And since fowl doesn't have milk, it's clearly not included in the verse. But the rabbi said, and we're about to see a source about that in another few minutes, the rabbi said it's also prohibited to have a cheeseburger from turkey. Right? Mm-hmm.
From Turkey the meat, not Turkey the country.
That's what I meant. Turkey and chicken.
Depending if it's halal or not.
Right.
And 3B, not just eating together, but even eating one after the other in the same meal. And number C, not just eating together in the same meal, but even milk after meat. Or meat after very hard cheese within 6 hours. That's certainly not in the Torah, It's a fence. Now, what's the reason for the fence? This 6-hour thing?
That they'll meet in the stomach.
You might say, like Ilana just said, but you also might say, no, that can't be. Because if Ilana was right, then meat after milk or milk after meat, it wouldn't matter. They would both be prohibited if the fear is that they meet in the stomach.
But 6 hours isn't universal either.
What about the intestines?
Say it again? Whatever, intestine, stomach, but it can't be that that's true. Because the prohibition is only meat and then milk, but it's not the opposite. You're allowed to have milk and then meat.
You can drink a glass of milk and then
have meat.
Yeah.
Really? Eat a piece of cheese and then...
Instantly, just have a piece of bread between them, or just wash out your mouth and floss.
Really?
Yeah.
It's in your mouth.
You didn't know that.
And therefore, Bob points out, the issue is in the mouth and not in the stomach. What's the issue in the mouth? That meat gets stuck in your teeth, but milk doesn't. And that's why we also have this matter of hard cheese. If you were to have very hard cheese, then you have to wait 6 hours for meat because of the remnants between the teeth. So the problem is in the mouth and not in the stomach. Once it's in the stomach, you can mix whatever you want.
So this is before the days of dental floss.
You could say that.
Or you can take out your false teeth.
Yes.
You can have two separate sets of teeth.
But also, I've actually heard of such things.
Really?
What about the tongue? The interior of the mouth. You can't have a second set of tongue.
Okay, so the truth is, I have heard of such things, of two separate sets of teeth, not specifically for meat and milk, but for Passover and for during the year. Okay.
6 hours isn't universal, though.
The 6 hours, just Adam, is not universal. You're right, there are very minor customs and out-of-the-way Jewish communities that hold 1 hour or 3 hours, but the almost universal custom is six hours.
And when we talk about rabbinic tradition, we're talking about the Sanhedrin? Or we're talking about Sanhedrin and later rabbis?
We're talking about later.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're about to look at some of those sources right now. So, we're in B on the sheet. B refers us to the two other appearances of our verse in the Torah. We looked at that already, so we'll go on to C. In C, I bring a three-way disagreement about the source of the three-way prohibition. What I mean is as follows. The verse says, don't cook, and we said it also includes don't eat and don't benefit from. What's the source of that expansion? We don't know. The Talmud gets it in tradition that that's what's forbidden, but why is it so? What's the source? We don't know. How do I know we don't know? Because the Talmud makes three different efforts. I take it back. The Talmudic tradition makes three different efforts to find the source of this tripartite prohibition. The fact that there are three different candidates for the source teaches you that we don't really know explicitly what the source is. So the most well-known understanding of why it's forbidden not just to cook but also to eat and benefit is what it says here in Babylonian Talmud Tractate Chulin, page 15b. The school of Rabbi Ishmael taught. Rabbi Ishmael is in the very beginning of the second century of the Common Era in the land of Israel. The school of Rabbi Ishmael taught, thou shalt not cook a kid in its mother's milk, is stated three times. One is a prohibition against eating it, one a prohibition against deriving benefit from it, and one a prohibition against cooking it.
Oh, so they take advantage of the three mentions.
Right. The assumption is the Torah doesn't waste words, doesn't say things that are unnecessary. If it wrote this prohibition three times, it must have three different meanings. Now that makes a certain degree of sense, except for the fact. What question could you ask against this?
Twice it agrees, word for word, it says exactly the same thing.
Three times it says the same thing.
Well, that narrow, but the context is the same in two of the times.
Okay.
Right?
So what's the difficulty we should bring up against this understanding of this source for deriving benefit and eating?
How do you know that that's specifically what it's talking about?
Because he
right.
Says so.
Say it again?
Because he says so.
No, but I'm asking, what's the difficulty you might bring up against this?
That there's nothing in the text that says it.
There's nothing in the text. I mean, I would think if the Torah meant to say don't eat it, it would have said.
Right? It's much less effort than to repeat it three times.
Right? One time say don't cook it, another time say don't eat it, another time say don't benefit.
Or say but one time don't eat it, don't cook it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is problematic. Mm-hmm. Problematic.
It feels forced.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so when you have different of the great rabbis, different interpretations of other things too, does that mean we don't know the true source? We don't know.
Absolutely.
Why that's why.
The Talmud is full of disagreement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to a large degree, not completely, to a large degree, the disagreement is not so much over the law, but over the reason,
source.
The source of the law, and sometimes over the details of the law. But it's amazing that although the Talmud is mostly disagreement, there's a large degree of agreement on the basic law, because there is a living tradition of this is what we do. Mm-hmm. But where it came from, and what do we do in different cases, which is also a function of what the reason is, what the source is, right? Depending on the source, you might have different understanding of what the details are of application in different circumstances. That is a matter of reason conjecture, because again, the tradition was lost. It was lost. So, okay.
Quick question, I forgot. It goes back to expanding the prohibitions to fowl and everything.
We'll get to that, fowl.
No, fish. Okay, but it's about fish. Is that included in that, in some of those prohibitions?
It's not included. There's a basic agreement that there's no prohibition of fish and milk.
I wonder why.
It's not the story.
Fish don't give milk, but then you say fowl do also. But of course, fowl looks similar to... And also, of course, fowl has to be shechted. Has to be kosher, whereas fish doesn't have to be.
The killing of fish has no process in Jewish tradition.
No process to killing fish. You could do whatever you want.
That's interesting.
Could a sworn dolphin issue milk?
Sit again, please.
Aren't dolphins mammals?
That's different. That's not a fish.
Okay.
Yes, I don't know what the law of dolphin.
Dolphins don't have scales, so they're not kosher.
That's
our scientific categorization.
Right, so I really don't know.
I didn't know, but they don't have cloven hoofs and they don't shoot
cows. That's true also. Right, they have nothing.
If it lives in water, it has to have scales and fins.
Not necessarily.
Oh, that's true, but let's go on. It's a different subject.
Yeah.
Next week we'll have a class on dolphins. Now, just two pages before 115b in the Babylonian Talmud, 113b is a different explanation of the source of this tripartite prohibition. We're at the bottom of the first side of the page. How do we know that one may not eat basar v'chalav, that you may not eat meat and milk? It says one should not eat anything which is abominable. That's a verse in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy 14. You can't eat something that is a to'eva, that is abominable, that is disgusting, that is anything which I despise is included and may not be eaten. Says the rabbis, what does it mean abominable? Anything that is an abominable, you can't eat. And therefore, the assumption is that that's why we can't eat meat and milk. Not because of the fact that it's written three times, but because once it's prohibited to be cooked, the assumption is that puts the result, the product, into a category of abominable. And there's another verse that we haven't read, Deuteronomy 14:3, that says you can't eat anything that is toiva. So you see clearly, this is a different derivation for the same law that you can't eat it. And then it says, and how do we know that it's prohibited to derive benefit from this mixture? As Rav Abahu says, any place where the Torah says, do not eat, a prohibition of benefit is implied. He says, the general rule. It's not because of it's written three times. But anything that you can't eat, And we learn you can't eat it because it's a to'eva. Therefore, we assume you also can't get benefit because prohibition of benefit is always a ramification of prohibition of eating.
So therefore, you cannot own a restaurant that does it serves non-kosher meat because you benefit.
Yeah, but if the meat is not kosher, then there's no prohibition of the cooking, and therefore there's no to'eva.
But
going back to what you said earlier,
that prohibition to eat is also prohibition to benefit.
So you shouldn't eat kosher meat because it's an abomination for not eating. You know, not
no. You shouldn't. You shouldn't benefit financially.
And therefore,
but if the meat is not kosher, there's no prohibition of meat and milk of not eating it. The prohibition is only on the non-kosher meat. So you're asking, irregardless of basar v'chalav, irregardless of meat and milk, what about non-kosher meat in general? This particular source says anything you can't eat, you can't benefit. Therefore,
exactly.
We'd say there's always prohibition of benefit on any non-kosher meat. Last line. Unless the Torah explicitly states otherwise, it does regarding nevelah.
You cannot buy stock in McDonald's.
No, the last line. Unless the Torah explicitly says otherwise, in other words, if it says explicitly you can't eat it, but you can get benefit, then you'll have to get benefit. In the case of non-kosher meat, the Torah says you can give it to your dog, or tishlach leklavim.
Oh.
And therefore the teachers, you can get benefit. That's an exception. According to this particular approach, it's an exception to normal rules.
All the customers are dogs.
That's not what it means.
The fact that it's non-kosher does not, that in and of itself, make it abominable. To a Jew, it should be abominable because it's not kosher.
That's very close to what we just said.
Well, if it's abominable, then the prohibition against eating anything that's abominable would apply, but it still doesn't make it improper to derive a benefit from it.
Because there's a specific exception,
right,
in the case of non-kosher meat that's explicit in the Torah, according to this particular source. But now we're going to see a third competing suggestion of what is the source of the tripartite prohibition, that it's not just cooking, but it's also eating and benefit. And that's the top of the page, the back side of the page. The Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I'll tell you something about this book in a minute. Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. This comes to forbid its cooking, all the more so its consumption.
Kal v'chomer.
Another, right? In other words, kal v'chomer, all the more so. If the Torah said don't cook it, what the Torah means is you can't even cook it. All the more so can't you eat it. Now, if the Torah says don't cook, it's assumed not to be an independent prohibition, but an extension of an unwritten prohibition of don't eat it. And it's saying don't even cook it. Even had it been written only once in the Torah, don't cook it, you'd know that don't cook it means don't even cook it. Of course, don't eat it. Now, what is this book, Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? On the one hand, I can tell you that it's a midrash, a halachic midrash, from the period of the Tanaim, in other words, from before the year 200 of the Common Era. So it's and it's on the book of Exodus. The halachic, Tanaitic, midrash, and the book of Exodus. And there are two different halachic, Tanaitic, midrashim on the book of Exodus. One's called the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael. The other is the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And these sources are from the same time as the Mishnah, and they provide us with authoritative understandings. This is even before the time of the Talmud, which begins in the year 200. So we now have here three ancient interpretations of why is the prohibition of cooking expanded to other things. We have one suggestion that it's all the more so, one suggestion that it's from the threefold mention of the verse in the Torah, and one suggestion that it's because it's toiva, once you cook it, and therefore you can't eat it. All of these three are competing, and we really don't know which is the original source. Perhaps none of them. Perhaps it's something else we don't know about. Now, here's something fascinating that's just a tangential thread from our discussion. But it's fascinating. Have any of you heard of the Geniza in Cairo?
Yes.
We were there.
You were there, okay. So, the Geniza in Cairo, say it again, Jim? I have not been there. The Geniza in Cairo is as follows. There's an ancient Jewish law and tradition that you don't throw away holy books. You don't throw away the Tanakh. You don't throw away any Jewish books. And in many Jewish communities, that was expanded to anything in Hebrew. Whether it was marriage documents, whether it was documents of sale, divorce documents, or just lists from the grocery store. If it was in Hebrew, correspondence, when in Hebrew, they didn't throw it out. Right? They put it in the Geniza, put it in a place where we preserve it more or less with respect, and then we take the material and bury it when we have a collection of material that needs to be buried. In Cairo, I think it's something from the 8th or 9th centuries, they use the upper story of the old synagogue in Fostat in Cairo as a Geniza. They just put everything there. And they never took it for burial for 1,000 years. Just remained there. And since the climate of Cairo is very, very dry, the material was more or less preserved. All of these old books and half books and quarter books and pages and fragments were preserved until 1895,
yes,
when it was discovered. The Jewish community had dwindled. They stopped using the Geniza. People forgot it was there. It was rediscovered in 1895. And there were literally truckloads of old books and half books and quarter books and pages and documents. It was trucked off by donkey and not by truck to Cambridge in England, to the library there, where it remained for decade upon decade. It took 50, 60 years even to begin to catalog all the material. And now listen to this. The Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is mentioned by many, many medieval rabbis as a source that they study, as a book that we have, that they learn halakha from. Except that by the time you get to the modern era, no one has seen a copy of this book for hundreds of years. It was lost. We lost it because it wasn't learned that much. The Talmud was learned, but the Mechilta was learned less, and it wasn't recopied. Books went out of circulation. They got ruined. They got destroyed. And we lost it. So you're now in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. We know there was once such a book, the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, but no one has seen it. Until in the Geniza, as they're cataloging the material, they suddenly realize, here's a page, another page, another page, another page from a book that must have been Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. We can see it's that book because it has in it lines that were quoted in the Middle Ages as coming from the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai.
Wow.
By the time you get to 1950s, there's a book published, a reconstruction of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's Mechilta. And in the past 50 years, as more pages have come to light in Geniza fragments that were miscataloged and now recataloged, and in fragments that they found in the library in Petersburg, the library in Munich, the library in Leningrad, but Petersburg and Leningrad are the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry about that. The book is being expanded. We find more and more pages from the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So in our generation, you can go to a Hebrew bookstore and buy the reconstructed Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Which means that for the modern era, until the 1950s and 60s, we didn't have this midrash that says this comes to forbid cooking, all the more so its consumption. And since we didn't have it, therefore, look at 3a. Look at 3a. Rambam, Mishneh Torah, Hilchot Machalot Aserot. The laws of forbidden foods, written in about 1170, 1175 by Maimonides. And he writes in his magnum opus of Jewish law, the Torah did not mention the prohibition of eating because it had already mentioned the prohibition of cooking, and therefore one not need mention cooking. In other words, it's an all the more so, says the Rambam, that the Torah says you can't eat it, and it's assumed it's all the more so that you cannot, the Torah mentioned cooking, eating is assumed, and cooking is the expansion of that. Now, students of the Rambam, of this line in the Mishneh Torah, in the 18th century, the 19th century, and the first half of the 20th century, Ritha Rama said, where in God's name did he get that from? The Talmud gives a different reason, two different reasons for the prohibition upon eating. The tripartite mention, or the toiva matter, but where did the Rambam get this all the more so from? And for over 300 years, scholars have broken their heads and written many lines and paragraphs and whole essays, what's the Rambam source? Until in the 1960s, Rabbi Menachem Kasher in Israel looked in the Geniza fragments, in this reconstructed book of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and said, the Rambam didn't make it up. He just got it from the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai.
So the Rambam had it in front of him.
Yeah. And we have today hundreds of cases in which difficult statements of Maimonides have now been understood simply because we found the source.
Hundreds
of cases like this. Hundreds of cases. The Rambam knew the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai as well as he knew the Talmud, and he took his sources, sometimes from here, sometimes from there, but all the halakhot that he learned from the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai were misunderstood until just 50 years ago. Really fascinating. So we only have 1 or 2 minutes left, perhaps 3, and I'd like to just talk about turkey and chicken, especially since we have the turkey now with the chili cook-off. We have to mention this. So this Babylon Talmud tractate Hulin, page 116a, Rabbi Akiva maintains that wild animals, non-domesticated like deer and antelope, that are kosher, and fowl like chicken and turkey, are not included in the prohibition of the Torah. You can have them with milk, but are prohibited rabbinically. You can't have them with milk only according to rabbinic prohibition. Whereas Rabbi Yossi Haglili maintains that fowl are not even prohibited by the rabbis.
Whoa.
And he can have turkey and pizza. There is also a bright to talk to the same effect. In the place of Rabbi Yossi Haglili, they used to eat fowl's flesh cooked in milk. Levi once visited the house of Joseph the Fowler and was served with a peacock's head cooked in milk. Must have been good. And said nothing to them about it.
Peacock is kosher?
I guess so. When he came to Rebbe, Rebbe is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince. The year is about 200 of the Common Era. And related this, Rebbe said to him, why did you not lay him under a ban? You should have excommunicated him, because all the Jews know we don't eat peacock and milk. And he was, so that's irreverent. He should have been excommunicated. He replied, because I didn't excommunicate him, because it was the place of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. He was the rabbinic authority there. And I imagine that he must have expounded to them the view of Rabbi Yossi Haglili, who was the teacher of Yehuda ben Beteira, who said fowl is excluded since it has no mother's milk.
Wow.
So indeed, there was such a custom, at least until the year 200 or 300 of the Common Era. But when that custom died out, then the Jewish people universally took upon themselves the approach of Rabbi Akiva, which is that fowl and milk is prohibited not by the Torah, but by rabbinic fence. And I'll just mention, since it's rabbinic fence, therefore it might be, it applies only to eating, but not to cooking and getting benefit. And there are those who say you're allowed to cook turkey and milk as long as you don't eat it. If you want to feed it to your dog, you can do that.
Well, the exclusion is just because of the rabbinic fence.
Because it's only rabbinic. And the fence is against eating, it might not be against cooking and getting benefit. Hmm. So time has run out. I guess you could look at the rest of it on your own. The rest of it is about what's the reason, what's the meaning of this prohibition. And I wrote an article for the Texas Jewish Post a while ago, and I included it here in the sheets I gave out to you, that talks about the why and the wherefore of this prohibition.
Where is the Texas? Where? We don't have the article.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. So, Bob,
where did the tradition of meat and fish being on separate tables, on separate plates, and on the same meal, where does that come from?
Right. The prohibition of mixing fish and meat, the Gemara says it causes leprosy.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
In other words, it's a health matter.
Thyroid.
And that brings us, of course, to the question, what happens to prohibitions of the Talmud that turn out to be, in later generations, non-scientific, do we reverse them or do we not reverse them? And that's a matter of great discussion. Leave it at that.
So there are meals where you'll have meat and fish, but people put them on separate plates just to, as an acknowledgement of the tradition.
Okay. Right.
There's
right.
Someplace in the Talmud that says it.
The Talmud says that fish and meat causes leprosy.
Yep, that makes sense. And it may have been
okay.
Raw meat and cheese.
You're determined to have your cheese.
They have raw meat and cheese. Or pickled meat.
Well, just like we're not allowed to eat together cooked meat and cheese, even if not cooked together, but just in the same meal, so I'm sure that would be forbidden, and not so healthy.
It's not cooked.
I hear.
Especially in raw meat.
Really?